This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Atheists, agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Gods, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, Jay. How you doing?
I'm good.
I'm good, too. So that's good. All right. So I don't know. It just seemed kind of like a downer. On the regular show, you know, you don't normally have a thing, but it was just like there wasn't a thing. And I've come to count on that. And I'm just find myself disappointed.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
But that's okay. I'm used to being let down by the world. Anyway, so let's get into it. There are a number of things we wanted to talk about on this midweek show. The first being a Supreme Court case, actually sort of two related cases, Gonzalez versus Google and Twitter versus Comna. And in both cases, it's being alleged that social media companies aided and abetted terrorism by knowingly providing terrorist organizations a platform to communicate and to recruit. In each of these cases, that the people bringing the cases argue led to the death of these individuals. And the main thing that distinguishes these cases is that in the Google case, the key question is whether Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act provides Google with immunity. Now, the Twitter case, at least at this point, doesn't raise any CDA issues. It's focused more on whether Twitter can be said to have knowingly provided substantial assistance to terrorist groups, which would be a violation of the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism
Act. Criminal charge. Yeah.
And I should point out, just as kind of an aside, the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act was vetoed by President Obama in 2016, overridden 97-1 in the Senate, 348-77 in the House, and was actually the only veto override of the Obama presidency. And if folks would remember back to that, there were concerns about how Saudi Arabia would react and some other things like that. But it was the one instance where I certainly agree with that override. But anyway, Jay, I thought maybe we could start on this by talking about what sort of protection Google or any other provider of an online service has under Section 230. And this is something we talked about before, but just to kind of make sure everyone's on the same page here, kind of to summarize, Section 230 says of the Communication Decency Act says that no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. And also that providers can't be held liable for any action voluntarily taken in good faith to restrict access to or availability of material that the provider or user considers to be obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable, whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. Now, on one hand, if Google isn't considered a publisher, but simply a medium through which the content's distributed, it would seem that there isn't any liability here. But on the other hand,
yes.
But on the other hand, there's this question that Deputy Attorney General Malcolm Stewart raised in oral argument this week. He said, what if a platform is able, through its algorithms, to identify users who are likely to be especially receptive to ISIS's message? What if it systematically attempts to radicalize them by sending more and more and more and more extreme ISIS videos? Does Section 230 protection still apply then? What do you think, Jay?
I think that's a really good question.
Yeah.
yeah.
You don't get to be deputy attorney general just because, you're.
I'm often mistaken for Supreme Court Justice, Mike. But look, as you point out, a little history is instructive here, right? In that Section 230 arose in 1996. This is when everyone was getting CDs from AOL.
God, yeah.
Right. Every day. To log in, and the internet was this vast new thing. And the concern was, newspapers can be held liable for publishing defamatory content, or obscene content, which I've heard there's some of that on the internet. The concern was, are we a publisher like a newspaper that could be held liable? Are we simply a community bulletin board? Or are we more like a telephone, right? I mean, if somebody picks up the phone and calls you and says something defamatory, can you sue the phone company? That was sort of the bargain that was struck was, these are a list of prohibited activities, right? The communications decency. Things that people cannot do online, but we are giving the services civil immunity in terms of their ability to they can't be sued for these statements, and also they are allowed to exercise what would be editorial control without being treated as a publisher, right? Because that's kind of the test, right? If you exercise editorial control, then you are in fact a publisher, and this has created an exception to that rule. And it seems to be a very wise and smart exception in that it's difficult for at least it really was difficult back in '96 for online platforms to edit and see everything that's being posted. I think it's less difficult now. But what we're talking about here is a situation where it's not a matter of acting as a publisher, but going even a step further, right? Of not even setting editorial control, but targeting. And that's something to me that the statute just really didn't address, because I don't know that the drafters of the statute, had thought that far ahead, or that was sort of technology that wasn't available, or I suppose it must have been dreamt of in those times, right? But the idea to continually target someone based on an algorithm, based on what they've already been interested in, is something that evolved much later.
I definitely
think that's the question. That I think it's just 230 as it's written does not seem to apply to what's going on here. I don't know the answer to this.
It seems to me that kind of as a matter of law, I think there's this common sense understanding of what a publisher is. And based on that common sense, not legal understanding, but the common sense understanding, these services have evolved into becoming publishers. But as a matter of law...
But the statute says you're not a publisher.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that, as you said, might have made a lot of sense in 1996, but I think today this is something that needs to be addressed in law and not through the courts. And Justice Kavanaugh said this in the oral arguments this week. He said, isn't it better to keep it the way it is for us to put the burden on Congress to change that, and they can consider the implications and make these predictive judgments? And Justice Kagan added on, it's not like we're the non-greatest experts on the internet. And I think exactly right here. So there's a big problem, but it is not a problem, I don't think, that should be addressed through the court, sort of a tortured, what would have to be a tortured interpretation of Section 230 of the CDA. And so in this sense, I think the Ninth Circuit was right. They said, as long as this came up from the Ninth Circuit, as long as the recommendations from the algorithms are content neutral, meaning that if you like cooking videos, you're like me, you like dog videos or pocket knife videos, that's what you get. And if you like jihad videos, well, you get more of those, then that protection applies, basically. And I think that's bad law now. It's outdated law. But until Congress updates it, that does provide that protection. But I do think that should change. That's my take. What do you think about that position?
No, I would seem to read it the same way. And my sense is that's probably where the court's going.
I don't think there's very much an inclination.
I would say that we had a long discussion on 230 revisions a while back, and I'm actually for some and against others, right?
And conservatives for the most part have a problem with that second part of it that allows these companies to implement their own rules for whatever they think might be objectionable, and that's they believe that's against conservatives, that sort of thing. Whereas liberals are kind of on the other side of that, obviously. But in this particular instance, it seems like we agree that even if we don't like the law, this is something to be handled by changing the law and not something that the court should step in and change, which it doesn't seem like they seem all that thrilled to be. They don't seem to be too inclined to want to do that in the first place.
Yeah.
Although no, I think that's... they did take the case, right? So there had to be at least some. They could have just said, no, we're going to deny the cert petition, but they didn't do that. So there was at least some interest in saying something potentially about it.
Hitting up this issue and saying, I mean, if nothing else, saying that the Section 230 that we drafted in 1996 is no longer meets the needs of 2023.
Yeah, and just sort of basically calling on Congress to change that, which is a different message than just saying, well, the Ninth Circuit ruling stands undisturbed, right? And so I think there is some advantage to taking the case and holding forth on it, even if it's to affirm the Ninth Circuit, to let them know that, hey, if you're in the Sixth Circuit or the Fifth Circuit, the same rules apply, basically. And that can be a useful thing, because the Constitution should mean, and the law should mean, federal law at least, should mean the same thing, whether you're in San Francisco or Cleveland.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well,
for at least most of the time.
Yeah,
some of the time.
There you go. So what about that argument that in the other case, that Twitter aided and abetted terrorism? Because in oral arguments there, Justice Kagan had this interesting thing to say. She said, if a bank can be held liable for knowingly providing financial services to a terrorist organization, which they can, then could Twitter potentially be held liable for knowingly providing communication services to a terrorist organization? And just like, we wouldn't say, except the banks claimed it, well, we're just a neutral provider of banking services, and hey, we'll provide banking services to Jay or to Mike or to Jihad Joe, what have you. We shouldn't accept Twitter's similar claim that it's just being neutral as to viewpoint or ideology or anything like that. Well, what do you think about that argument?
So I would say aiding and abetting is something that's different than just, I think there has to be a knowing element, right? To me, that's the, if there is a, if you have a service and terrorists exchange messages across it, without your knowledge that they're planning some terrorist activity, I don't think that qualifies as aiding and abetting. But, and again, I'm not a criminal law, that's not my area of expertise. Yeah, when you are aware of the messages and transferring the messages and supporting communications between bad actors, I think there could be a claim there. Because again, the argument, at this point isn't did they do it or not. It's could they be prosecuted? Could a prosecution proceed against them? It's not on the fact of it. So I think it does kind of turn on the facts. And at this point, I would say the facts would indicate, yeah, there could be a factual situation where they could be aiding and abetting. So,
and it gets into the question of what do we mean by knowingly? Like if you have a sense that maybe this could be happening, as opposed to being told clearly and unambiguously that these groups are using this and you have a duty to shut this down and you ignore that, that's a whole different kind of thing. You know, but I think what's probably more likely is the court basically punting this decision. And they could do that by deciding that essentially under the Anti-Terrorism Act, individuals and companies can only be held liable for aiding and abetting a person who's doing a terrorist thing, rather than aiding and abetting a kind of more generalized act of terrorism. And so, in other words, my point being is that the family, the Tamna family in this case, unless they can make a plausible claim that sort of persons directly responsible for Tama's death were aided and abetted, those individuals were aided and abetted by Twitter, kind of connect those dots, as opposed to just saying, well, Twitter's used by a lot of these folks who are engaged in this behavior. It seems to me that you can say, well, under the language of the statute, that does not qualify as directly aiding and abetting. It's maybe something we don't like, but it doesn't mean that you necessarily have grounds to bring a suit. I mean, that's kind of how I read this, at least.
Yeah. So I would agree with you on that.
And maybe it's best that the court, I guess I get uneasy when the court kind of weighs into these things, even if there's an outcome that I think would be my preferred outcome, certainly. You know, I don't want Twitter aiding and abetting knowingly or unknowingly terrorism, but having the court sort of make what I feel to be questionable or tortured interpretations of statutes just so they can achieve my preferred policy end is something that leaves me deeply uneasy.
Yeah, no, same here.
So there we go. All right. Well, why don't we move on to another case? This is actually a case that the Supreme Court unfortunately declined to hear. And I think that's a big disappointment here. It's also kind of near and dear to my heart. The case is Novak versus City of Parma. And I grew up on the west side of Cleveland, right next to Parma, that kind of hometown connection. I spent all kinds of time at the Parmatown Mall back in the day. And there's also, for me, at least a Novak connection. I don't know Andrew Novak. This is the guy who asked the court to hear this case in appeal from the Sixth Circuit. But I did have a huge grade school crush on Julie Novak. And so I don't know if they're related at all. Could be his kid. That's scary. But there you go. So that's a little personal information there. That did not turn out well. But anyway, so interesting connection. So Anthony Novak, anyway, who may or may not be related to the Julie Novak I knew back in the day, he created a parody Facebook page in 2016 that made fun of the Parma Police Department, after which he was arrested and indicted based on an Ohio state law that bans the use of a computer to disrupt police functions. Novak was acquitted by a jury, and then he sued the police in the city of Parma, arguing that his free speech rights had been violated. His argument was basically that he was exercising a fundamental American right of mocking government officials in parody posts that included, among other things, an offer for free abortions in a police van, a pedophile reform event with games and quizzes, and the opportunity for pedophiles to become honorary members of the Parma police force. Stuff pretty broad satire, right? Now, the district court held and the Sixth Circuit affirmed that the doctrine of qualified immunity means that Novak can't bring a civil suit against the police. He claimed his arrest was retaliation for the mocking, but the Sixth Circuit said, well, there's no recognized right to be free from retaliatory arrest supported by probable cause. And in the end, they ruled that the officers reasonably, even if mistakenly, concluded that probable cause existed. And there were a lot of interesting amicus briefs to the Supreme Court here urging that they hear the case. There are the ones you'd expect, ACLU of Ohio, the Cato Institute, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. But there were also a couple of far more entertaining briefs, the two that I really enjoyed, from the Babylon Bee and the Onion. And in its brief, the Babylon Bee starts off by calling itself a dangerous far-right misinformation site that typically peddles fake news, but when its writers are up for more of a challenge, occasionally uses satire to draw on and reinforce actual misinformation and conspiracy. And in their brief, they argue that the Sixth Circuit's ruling, if allowed to stand, allows the state to punish vast swaths of speech erstwhile protected by the First Amendment. And the fact that Novak wasn't convicted by the jury does little, if anything, to lessen the chilling effect on speech. They call the Sixth Circuit's decision qualified immunity on steroids. And they also defend their fellow amicus briefers at the Onion, writing that while they may be staffed by socialist wackos, they're arm in arm with these socialist wackos on this issue. And for its part, the Onion's brief notes that, well, it rose from its humble beginnings in 1756 and now enjoys a daily readership of 4.3 trillion, which of course makes it the single most powerful and influential organization in human history. Once you get past that, though, in its brief, the Onion argues that parody functions in large part by tricking people into thinking that it's real, and that requiring that a parody be clearly indicated removes a lot of its force. They say, without the capacity to fool someone, parody is functionally useless, deprived of the tools inscribed in its very etymology that allow it again and again to perform this rhetorically powerful sleight of hand. It adopts a particular form in order to critique it from within. And that a reasonable reader doesn't need a big disclaimer to get this, at least eventually, that parody isn't the actual thing that it's parodizing. So, Jay, what do you think about all this? I guess, you know, the applicability of the Ohio statute in question of this case, the Sixth Circuit's ruling, and whether or not the Supreme Court was right to not grant cert on this.
Oh, I wish the court would have granted cert on this.
Me too.
Just for those reasons. You know, the Sixth Circuit originally had sided with Novak in an earlier stage in the case. Judge Tappar written that, you know, imagine if the Onion had to post that this was a satire on every issue, every time they posted, they printed something. Obviously, yeah, you missed the joke. It's gone. I think the Sixth Circuit's decision is based on the thing that you and I have talked about a couple times on qualified immunity. And that is, if you don't have the clearly defined constitutional right, which means, like, you know, this almost exactly factual scenario has occurred before and been found unconstitutional, then you're going to get the qualified immunity. So in some ways the case was, I don't want to say not a big deal, but not necessarily, you know, breaking new legal ground there, right? There was nothing that would be a new holding. The Sixth Circuit relied on precedent of this is how these things are treated, rightly or wrongly, and decided it. But I think the writers made their point, even though the case was not taken up by the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, it's sort of funny. I mean, what they'll take on cert and what they don't. And a lot of times it comes down to just what else they've got on the table. Sometimes it comes down to vehicle issues, right? Sometimes you can have the same case, but it would be much better made by different facts, or a case that might have some procedural bumps in it that it's easier if you have a case without the procedural bumps. So yeah, I would say it's not impossible that the U.S. Supreme Court might not take up another case on qualified immunity, sometime in the future. But it just passed on this one, and hopefully that the Onion and Babylon Bee will be there as well. There was also I'm thinking of other, you know, one of the great first satirical briefs, P.G. O'Rourke wrote one, and I'm trying to think what the case was. But yeah, it sort of started off with the line of, "This is the single greatest brief ever written in this court." Sort of the profanity. But again, the whole nature of the idea of protecting parody. So I think what I'm saying is, I think the court may look at this as the court probably was looking at this less as a free speech right to parody case, and more of a qualified immunity case.
We hope you enjoyed this preview of our supporters exclusive midweek show. If you'd like to hear the rest of the episode, we hope you'll consider becoming a supporter. Supporters get ad-free access to all of our shows, membership in our Politics Guys Discord group, where you can join in on the conversation, and other benefits at different levels of support. To become a supporter, go to patreon.com/politicsguys. You can also support us through Venmo, we're at politicsguys, or through PayPal. You'll find all of our support links in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And if you'd like to get the midweek show, but you're not in a position to become a financial supporter, that's not a problem. Just send me an email at mike@politicsguys.com, and I'll be happy to get that set up for you.